very much. Of course, I want to thank the organizers for inviting me to this beautiful place and beautiful conference. I also want to thank Philip Stamp for the talk he gave this morning, because that's basically the good complement to what I'm going to talk about. I will tell you the experimental part of the story about spin bath and what that tells us for our understanding of decoherence. So the best place, the best place to study spin bath problems is in single molecule magnets. These are stoichiometric chemical compounds made based on large molecules, which have a core of magnetic ions. This is, for example, the manganese 12, surrounded by organic ligands. And in this core, you have, for example, here you have 4 manganese 4 plus ions with spin 3½, 8 manganese 3 plus with spin 2. And these magnetic moments are coupled to each other quite strongly by exchange interactions. So at low enough temperature, all this big molecule behaves as a nanometer sized giant spin. In this case, it's got spin S equal 10. And these materials normally come in the form of crystals, so they pack up in a regular crystalline structure. And except for a few exceptions, there is hardly any direct interaction between the molecules. There's only dipolar interaction. And this is very convenient because it allows you to use all the solid state experimental techniques you know about to do, to a large extent, actually single molecule studies. However, I would like at least to tell you a few words about some very recent progress that's been done in this field, about trying to put in a controlled way these molecules on surfaces. For example, this is a self-assembled monolayer on native gold. These are manganese 12 molecules. The nice thing about manganese 12 is that you can keep the same magnetic core and change the organic ligands around and have sort of functional groups on the outside that have some special features. For example, this is with thiol groups. This sticks like an octopus. It sticks to the gold. So they attach to the gold, and they also want to stay close to each other. So you can easily make a self-assembled monolayer. If you use, again, with manganese 12, but just changing the ligands, you get molecules that stick to the gold, but they don't want to be too close to each other. So you can get isolated single molecules on the surface. You can do even more sophisticated stuff. This is really cool, I think. These are, you see these dark spots here? These are islands of manganese 12 molecules buried into polycarbonate. And they are made to exactly reproduce a DVD master. So you take a DVD, you transfer it onto polycarbonate with manganese 12 inside, and then by applying some gaseous solvents, it's a whole procedure, you get these islands that exactly reproduce the DVD track. And then you can read it out with a magnetic force microscope. You read the DVD in a magnetic way. You can also make patterns, for example, on silicon. This is done with a stamp. You prepare a stamp, for example, this is to make some stripes. You put it on a silicon surface which has been covered with manganese 12 in solution. You let the solvent evaporate, and many molecules go underneath the tips of the stamp, and then you get these patterns like this. So I won't tell you more about this, but I really want you to know that these things exist, and they're growing really fast. This will become very important very soon, I think. Okay, back to basics. One of the most important physical properties of these materials is their magnetic anisotropy. Because of the crystal field splittings and the symmetry of the molecule, the magnetic moment of the molecule prefers to align along a certain crystallographic direction. Let's call it Z. So you can describe this with an effective spin Hamiltonian with a term like minus D as Z squared. So that originates an energy level scheme that looks like this. The eigenstates, of course, are also eigenstates of a Z. So they are this projection along the Z axis. They have, you know, different energies becoming doublets of degenerate states on opposite sides of the barrier. So classically, if you want to flip the spin, you need to apply, you need to supply enough energy to overcome this anisotropy barrier, which in the case of manganese 12 is about 65 Kelvin high. Okay? However, you see, of course, this molecule does not really have rotational symmetry around the z-axis. It's a bit more complicated than that. This molecule, for example, has four-fold symmetry, S4. So you need to include also S plus to the fourth and S minus to the fourth term in the spin Hamiltonian. And you see, these ones do not commute with a Z. So these ones are not actually the real eigenstates anymore. They get mixed with each other. So quantum mechanically, you can revert the direction of the spin by quantum tunneling through the anisotropy barrier. Notice that this is quite remarkable, because when I say that the spin is tunneling through the barrier, that's the spin of a whole molecule. All the d electrons of all these 12 manganese ions have to flip all together. There are 44 of them if you count them up. It's not a small system. So strictly speaking, now the real eigenstates of this spin Hamiltonian are no longer the spin up and spin down states, but they are quantum superpositions of them. You can make them symmetric and anti-symmetric, that is separated by a gap, delta, which is the Tanami splitting. And it's a rather macroscopic superposition. They are largely different states that you superimpose. Now, when this is due only to crystal field splittings, this Tanami splitting is actually very small. In manganese 12, it's 10 to the minus 11 Kelvin. It's really small. There are other molecules where you can get it up to maybe 10 to the minus 7, 10 to the minus 6, but it's always much smaller than any coupling to the environment you can think of. So here, the Tanami will certainly be incoherent. And moreover, you may ask yourself, how can it happen in the first place? I mean, what is the chance that these two levels will be in resonance within 10 to the minus 11 Kelvin? That's one thing that took a while to realize. The important point is that you can add non-diagonal terms in the spin Hamiltonian artificially by just applying a magnetic field which is perpendicular to the easy axis of magnetization. So you can crank up this Tanami splitting by orders of magnitude just by applying a Stirner field. And then you can reach the regime where, given the typical strength of the couplings of the molecule to other environmental degrees of freedom, you can get into the regime where you can enter the coherence operation. So you may hope to see coherent tunneling of the giant spin. That's the coherence window that Philip was talking about this morning. So when you reach this, that hasn't been done yet. Nobody has ever seen time-resolved quantum tunneling oscillation in that. That's actually a project I'm working on now. Anyway, then you have a prototype for a spin qubit with easily tunable operating frequency. But what I really want to talk about today is the fact that we can use this system as benchmarks to understand the spin bath decoherence. Because everything I told you so far was about the electron spins in these manganese ions. But the manganese nucleus has a nuclear spin, spin 5-half, which is coupled to the electron spins by hyperfine interaction. So that's an intrinsic source of decoherence you cannot get rid of. But the good news is that you know exactly what it is. Contrary to most solid-state qubits, where you know your two-level systems are defects in the substrate or some other unknown sources of decoherence, here we know exactly what they are, where they are, because we know the crystal structure. We know even the couplings. We know everything. So this is a place where you can really compare the experiment and the theory, and it has to match in the end. For example, one of the first great successes of the spin bath theory, as we know it now, was to understand how can this big giant spin tunnel in the first place, given how small the tunneling splitting is. The reason was that the nuclear spins themselves have some intrinsic dynamics. So that that field that the nucleus produces on the electron and that brings the electron spin states out of resonance so they cannot tunnel is actually dynamic, it's not static. And if you take that into account, you get some sweeping through the tunneling resonance, which basically unlocks the molecules. So the intrinsic dynamics of the nuclear spin bath is what allows tunneling to take place in the first place. So it was clear, it was essential to understand this nuclear spin dynamics to understand how the whole electron spin dynamics is triggered by that. And it turns out that this is a very convenient system to do so because thanks to the anisotropy below, let's say, 2-3 Kelvin, the electron spins are already frozen along their easy axis for times that are long enough to do NMR experiments using only the hyperfine field. So you can do NMR in zero external field just using the internal hyperfine field, which is, depending on the site where you look, between 21 and 34 Tesla. It comes for free. You don't need to go to a high field magnet facility. You just get it for free from the chemists. And then the residual fluctuations of the electron spin will possibly be the ones that drive and enhance the nuclear spin dynamics, but also remember, otherwise, the nuclei trigger the electron spin dynamics as well. So we study that by NMR. For example, one of the things we do is to study the inversion recovery. That's the way to measure T1. You start with an initial equilibrium magnetization of the nuclear spins. You flip them 180 degrees, and then you wait some time and you measure by spin echo how much the polarization along Z is at that time. You do it over and over again, changing this time, you can reconstruct the way the spins come back to equilibrium. Now, for those of you who appreciate these things, these are single-shot measurements. There is no averaging here. You don't get that every day in NMR. That's pretty clean. Okay, so let's start with some results. This is the nuclear relaxation rate, so the inverse T1, if you want, between 1 and 2 Kelvin. You see, it's got a roughly exponential temperature dependence, which you can understand because in that temperature regime, you mainly have this thermally assisted excitations between the ground states and some higher excited states. But this, of course, will vanish down exponentially if you cool down further. So if you would extend this line down to millikelvin temperature, you get relaxation times that are huge. Now, will that really happen? We tried that, and, well, no. It flattens out, it becomes roughly temperature independent, down to 20 millikelvin. So this is the first smoking gun that there is some quantum dynamics driving this nuclear spin relaxation. However, when you look at the numbers, see, this plateau tells you that T1 here is 30 seconds. This doesn't seem to make sense because we know that the tunneling rate of these molecules is once in a couple of months. The relaxation rate is 2 years, relaxation times 2 years. I'll come back to this in a second, but there's some other thing we can do to check that this really has to do with resonant tunneling. You can apply an external field, longitudinal, along the z-axis, so you break the symmetry of this barrier. You reinforce these states on opposite sides of the barriers to be out of resonance, and then that cannot be tunneling anymore. And indeed, the nuclear relaxation just falls off. So that's good news. Now, to understand how can that be so fast in the first place, I have to tell you that this special material I worked on, is the manganese 12 acetate, is peculiar because there is always some percent, 5 to 8% of the so-called fast relaxing molecules. These are molecules that are exactly the same as all the others, but you see these thick white lines, these are the elongated Jahn-Teller axes that basically set the anisotropy for the single manganese ions. In these fast molecules, one of the Jahn-Teller axes is flipped, is perpendicular to the z-axis. So that reduces the barrier that gives extra non-diagonal terms in the spin Hamiltonian, so you get a faster tunneling rate. Also, this is just a speculation I want to throw at you. These molecules are so diluted in the sample and coupled by dipolar interaction. It looks very much like the anti-glass that people have seen in dilute lithium-ohmium tetrafluoride systems, where they see that even at very low temperature, these spins never freeze. They keep on fluctuating. It's just a speculation anyway. The point is now, what I see is that all the nuclei in all the sample relax within 30 seconds. Also the ones that are in slow molecules that are frozen there for months. So there has to be a way to couple nuclear spins between fast molecules and slow molecules. This was postulated when setting up the spin bath theory, that that's one of the elements of the internal dynamics of the nuclear spin, is nuclear spin diffusion. We can actually demonstrate that. This is a T2 measurement. It's the echo decay as a function of the delay between the first and the second pulse. You can see this is a 20 millikelvin. Okay? So there's basically no fluctuation left, except for every once in a while some tunneling events in the fast molecules. But what you're left with for the nuclei is that if you take two nuclei in exactly the same crystallographic place in two neighboring molecules, they are, you know, equivalent in all senses, so they can undergo flip-flop processes, and that will give you, you can calculate that, it's the old von Fleck formula, you can calculate, that will give you a certain echo decay, which fits very well also quantitatively with the experiment. The thing we can do is we can either prepare the sample fully polarized, so with all the clusters pointing in the same direction, or demagnetize, so half of the clusters up and half of the clusters down. And then, you see, nuclei that are in neighboring molecules which point in opposite direction, they are not magnetically equivalent anymore, so they cannot flip-flop with each other. It's the same as diluting the sample by a factor of 2, and then the T2 should get longer by a factor square root of 2, which is exactly what you see. So this was the long-sought nuclear spin diffusion. But now there is some deeper aspect I want to tell you about. It's the nuclear spin temperature. You see, I showed you that below 1 Kelvin, these nuclear spins are basically relaxed by some temperature-independent quantum fluctuation. So are they actually in thermal equilibrium? Is that T1 a real spin lattice relaxation rate? Well, we can measure that. You measure the spin temperature, and it turns out, yes, they are. At very low temperature, you never cool them down to really 20 millikelvin, because here you would basically start to really polarize them. It takes a lot of entropy. So if you want, the hyperfine specific heat becomes very large. So I never managed to cool them down below, let's say, 50 millikelvin. But, you know, the trend is pretty clear. Already at 0.8 Kelvin, It's only quantum fluctuation that relax them, and they are cooled down all the way. Also, this is, if you want, the certificate of quality of an NMR experiment. It means that I'm really cooling down the whole thing. But what that also means is that, you see, the nuclei do not have any direct coupling to the lattice. If they are relaxed, they have to do that via the electron spins. So also the electron spins should be in thermal equilibrium. Now, the manganese 12 is a bit of a special system because of these minority molecules that are the ones that give the quantum dynamics. But generally, you would expect, if the electron spins are in thermal equilibrium and they have some interaction, at least the dipolar interaction with each other, they may find some long-range order state at low temperature. And actually, we were the first to find it out. This is the manganese 6 molecule. It's a bit special in the sense that it has virtually no anisotropy. You see, it's an octahedron. It's a very symmetric shape. So even though the single ions are anisotropic, the whole molecule is virtually not anisotropic. That is, you can tell, if you measure the specific heat, you can single out the phonon contribution. There is a small crystal field anisotropy at very small temperature. The nuclear spins, you don't see them here. And then there is this ordering anomaly at 0.16 Kelvin. It's pretty low because it's only dipolar interaction between them. And then you get a peak in the AC susceptibility as well. But then 1 year later, the other colleagues of mine found in the specific heat of this other molecule, this is the manganese 4. It's a bit smaller, but especially it's less symmetric. So this has some sizable anisotropy. So it does have quantum tunneling, which you don't have in a manganese 6 because there is no barrier, right? So here you have quantum relaxation. You can see the contribution of the anisotropy barrier to the specific heat is shifted to higher temperatures. You can find out the phonons as well. And then you get this ordering anomaly as well. At low temperatures, about 0.2 Kelvin. You see, if you cool down further, you see the equilibrium specific heat of the nuclei. So indeed, the whole electron spin and nuclear spin system is in thermal equilibrium. It finds long-range ordering, and it cools down the nuclear spin. So we're kind of attacking the problem from two sides. This quantum tunneling does relax both the nuclei and the electron. It's the whole combined system. But we don't have an explanation for that yet. There is no theory at present time that explains how can this thing happen. How do we thermalize the electron and the nuclear spins by quantum tunneling fluctuations? So this is one big mystery so far. I want to tell you one more mystery, which happens when you do muon spin relaxation. I'll just tell you quickly. The muon is basically, magnetically, it's a light proton. A particle physicist would tell you it's a heavy positron. But anyway, it's a particle that decays by beta decay after an average time of 2.2 microseconds. You can prepare a beam of highly polarized muons, implant them in a sample. And then once they are inside of the sample, due to the local field fluctuations, they will relax this 100% polarization that they have. And then after some time, that of course varies randomly, but on average about 2 microseconds, they will decay, emitting a positron and a neutrino. And the positron is preferentially emitted along the direction of the spin. So then you take some statistics with some detectors, and you can find what is the polarization of the muon as a function of time after the implantation. In principle, it should give you the same information as NMR, but it's a really single particle local probe, and it's fully polarized at the beginning. What we find, this is in the manganese 12 acetate, the one with fast relaxing molecules, is something that is absolutely incomprehensible. In zero field, the muon relaxation becomes about 50 nanoseconds, down to 12 millikelvin. I mean, you would expect, since the muon is sensitive to microsecond timescales, it should just, you put it in the sample, it just wait to die and decay and see nothing in microseconds time. It relaxes in nanoseconds time. If you apply a field, you kill that all. I mean, when me and other people first saw these things, this has been seen in several different molecular magnets. We show quantum tunneling at zero field. Nobody could believe that this could have anything to do with quantum tunneling because the timescale is just orders of magnitude way off. Then we got more recently from George Christos' group, they managed to make a manganese 12 molecule which has the same magnetic core as usual, but this has no fast relaxing molecule. And indeed, well, this one slows down at low temperature. However, here, unfortunately, we didn't have beam time in the dilution phase, so we didn't go to millikelvin, but we saw it already kind of flattening down already below 5 Kelvin. So I don't know whether it will go all the way down to millikelvin that way, but my bet is that it may well happen. So, I mean, this really doesn't seem to make any quantitative sense. But as I said, it's been seeing all of the molecules that show quantum time. So can we find some system which is otherwise, let's say, equivalent to these ones, but with no quantum timing in zero field? Yes. There is one system, I'm sure Josh Christie will tell you much more about this tomorrow, or whenever he's speaking. These are manganese 4 dimers. So this is made out of manganese 4 molecules, just like the ones I showed you that they order ferromagnetically. But here, it's quite a peculiar thing, because of the ligands and the interaction between pairs of molecules, you have an anti-ferromagnetic super exchange path. So these molecules basically lock each other into opposite spin directions. And if you want to make one of the molecules flip by quantum tunneling, you have to apply an external field that compensates for this exchange, bias. So there is no tunneling in zero field. We know that for sure. So if all that fast neural relaxation we saw in the other materials has anything to do with quantum dynamics, it should not appear here. And indeed, it does. This is, to my knowledge, the only molecular magnet where you see a healthy behavior. The neural relaxation slows down at low temperatures. And it's the only one where there is no quantum dynamics in zero field. So although it's a big mystery, we just don't understand this, but it's very interesting. And there's lots of experimental evidence for this. So with this I'm concluding, I'll just summarize what I tried to show to you, is that we have a wealth of very detailed experimental information about the quantum dynamics of these molecules as seen by local probes. We have demonstrated nuclear spin diffusion, some essential element of the intrinsic dynamics of the nuclei. We have seen that there is thermal equilibrium in the nuclei and in the electron spins given by quantum dynamics. We have seen that there is some inexplicably fast dynamics seen by polarized local probes. But the message I would like you to take home is that we don't know yet whether this will be the ultimate spin qubit for quantum computation. But for sure, all this complicated physics that we see in the incoherent regime contains the same information that will determine the decoherence rate in the coherence regime. So here we have a system that is a benchmark to study decoherence, especially due to spin bucks, because we can move all the way smoothly from the incoherent to the coherent regime, and we know what the couplings to the environment are. We can even look at them directly with experiments. Okay? So with this I finish. I'd like to thank, of course, all the people that have been collaborating with me in these years. Now I'm at UBC Vancouver, so there are lots of theoreticians who are helping me with that. Walter Hart is now helping me to set up this coherence experiment that I hope will happen very soon. These are my old colleagues at the Commonly Known as Lab in Leiden. These are the people I work with in Triumph, that's the new facility in Vancouver. Marco Evangelisti was another colleague who was doing the specific heat measurements. These are the chemists who make all this research possible in the first place, some others, and our funding institution, and I thank you for your attention.
Quite a few questions. When you, if you look at a more conventional solid like, say, manganese chloride, where you have a conventional electronic amplifier magnet, what's been observed in that type of system is that when you go through a phase transition, such as amplifier magnet to spin pop or whatever, you get very fast relaxation of the nuclear spin system. And the reason for that is that right at that phase transition, there's a soft mode of the magnets. The magnetic energy state down to zero across the nuclear levels, and then the nuclear can relax. And that also couples in because right at the phase transition, the specific peak of the magnetic path goes up. So it doesn't relax in the soft mode. And I was just wondering, that, you know, this manganese 12 system, do you, I mean, when you're doing quantum tunneling, you're physically flipping the electron spin.
Yeah.
Is there some equivalent mechanism at that level that sort of carries over from the more conventional analog?
Well, you see, the difference is that it is a it's a resonance tunneling phenomenon, and therefore it's something that happens only at random times. You don't have a continuous, for example, you cannot make actual, at least we don't have a way to understand whether this really happens. You cannot make like mutual flip-flops of spins like that. Or probably you can, but we don't have a right way to understand this yet. It's something that should be built in there, but we don't quite know it theoretically yet. You see, the point is that normally these molecules are frozen. They just don't do anything. And then, by some random changes in the external bias, which can come from the nuclear spins or can come from neighboring electron spins, they find a tunneling resonance and they flip. Okay? So it's not something that goes continuously. So in that sense, it's different from the standard, let's say, anti-ferromagnetic, paramagnetic or paramagnetic salt that we know about. But we have the feeling that there is something we don't understand in the process of incoherent quantum tunneling driven by fluctuations of the environment. Essentially, what we don't understand is we know from all these experiments that there has to be a way to discriminate whether you are flipping from a state which goes from low energy to high energy or otherwise. There is no theory nowadays that explains to you how this ever happens.
I just wondered if you have like a zero gap, energy gap fluctuation in the
Andrea, the last slide that you showed, you just said that basically we know the physics behind this.
Well, we know the experimental physics behind this. Right. Point I'm trying to make is that the theory behind this is not complete. I mean, this feedback theory, as we know it now, is not wrong, but it's not sufficient.
Okay.
So whenever you want to make a good theory for the decoherence rate, when that will be measured effectively, well, you will have to check that theory, that explanation for this decoherence rate, against the theory that may explain to you all these phenomena, because it's the same physics behind both.
Right, okay. Now, your spin bath in this case, are the nuclei, or
the Yeah, the nuclear spins.
Okay.
And that's why we can look at what they do. You see, we can do NMR on the origin of the coherence itself. We know what they are and where they are.
You mentioned this business that the environment fluctuates.
Yeah.
Once in a while, the two things get into resonance and they tunnel.
Yeah.
That's a kind of classical picture to say that it's an asymmetric well.
Mm-hmm.
You just absorb an excitation of the environment, gives you enough energy to go into the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that I think opens an interesting question. If you do the whole experiment in a mesoscopic environment, and the system is finite, then the excitations of the environment will not be a continuum. They will not be able to give you real transitions. In your language, it will mean that they will never get it exactly into resonance.
It would be
interesting to do finite sample measurements.
Well, the thing is that the environment has a very thick spectrum. You see, these nuclear spin states, they're very, very close to each other. That's why you can get into the resonance.
If the environment is
Okay, so if you have like just a few nuclear spins coupled to that, yes. Yeah, that would be very interesting.
If there are no further questions, join me in thanking you.